In 1932, three young philosophers, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and Raymond Aron, sat drinking apricot cocktails at the Bec de Gaz bar in Paris when philosophy changed forever. Aron, freshly returned from studying in Berlin, excitedly told his friends about phenomenology, a philosophy that bypassed abstract theories to focus on lived experience. "If you are a phenomenologist," he explained to Sartre, "you can talk about this cocktail and make philosophy out of it." Sartre reportedly turned pale with excitement, immediately purchased Edmund Husserl's ideas, and later arranged to study in Berlin himself. This seemingly ordinary moment in a Parisian café marked the birth of modern existentialism, a philosophy that would dominate mid-20th century intellectual life and continue shaping how we understand freedom, authenticity, and human experience today. Existentialism's cultural impact extended far beyond academic philosophy. By the late 1940s, it had become a genuine cultural phenomenon, with Sartre's 1945 lecture, Existentialism and Humanism, drawing such crowds that women reportedly fainted in the heat. The Catholic Church placed Sartre's works on its Index of Prohibited Books, while Marxists attacked his emphasis on individual freedom. Yet these condemnations only enhanced existentialism's appeal among the young and rebellious, who adopted black turtlenecks and gathered in left-bank cafes like The Floor and Domagoz. Journalists eagerly reported on Sartre and Beauvoir's unconventional relationship, which they viewed not merely as a personal arrangement but as a philosophical choice, living their theory of freedom by rejecting traditional marriage and bourgeois values. While modern existentialism crystallized in mid-20th century Paris, its intellectual foundations were laid by 19th century thinkers who rebelled against abstract philosophical systems and emphasized concrete human experience. This philosophical movement emerged as a response to the increasingly mechanistic and rationalistic worldview of the Enlightenment, seeking to restore focus on individual human existence. Søren Kierkegaard, born in Copenhagen in 1813, first used existential to denote thought concerning human existence problems. Physically irregular with a twisted spine, he lived a solitary life, but occasionally took people baths around Copenhagen, dragging acquaintances on philosophical walks through the city streets. His personal struggles with melancholy and religious faith deeply informed his philosophy. He challenged Descartes' "I think, therefore I am," arguing that existence precedes any statements about it, and rejected Hegel's grand philosophical system that subsumed individuals into absolute spirit. For Kierkegaard, constant choosing brings pervasive anxiety, the dizziness of freedom, and the answer to this anguish was a leap of faith into God's arms. He identified three stages of existence: the aesthetic, pursuit of pleasure; the ethical, commitment to duty; and the religious, embrace of the absurd through faith. Friedrich Nietzsche, born in Prussia in 1844, provided another crucial foundation for existentialist thought through his radical critique of traditional values and emphasis on individual self-creation. He rejected both Christianity and traditional philosophy as veils over life's harsh realities, proposing a genealogy, uncovering how humans came to be as they are. Nietzsche famously declared that God is dead and argued we must affirm every moment of life without resentment through his concept of eternal recurrence. His idea of the Übermensch, often translated as Superman, represented the possibility of self-overcoming and creating new values. Though his body betrayed him to dementia in his 40s, his vision of existence as choice and self-assertion profoundly shaped later existentialist thinkers, particularly in their emphasis on authenticity and rejection of fixed human nature. The third major influence came from Edmund Husserl's phenomenology, which provided the methodological approach that existentialists would adopt. Husserl's command to return to the things themselves meant stripping away distractions, habits, and presumptions to focus on phenomena as they appear in direct experience. Using a cup of coffee as an example, phenomenology sets aside both abstract scientific facts and personal sentimental associations to focus on the immediate experience, the aroma, steam, warmth, and flavor. This bracketing out of speculations, called epico, liberates us to discuss experiences seriously, whether wine tasting, music appreciation, religious experiences, or medical symptoms. This method became crucial for existentialist thinkers like Sartre and Merleau-Ponty, who used it to analyze consciousness, embodiment, and human freedom. Phenomenology's emphasis on direct experience aligned perfectly with existentialism's focus on concrete human existence rather than abstract theoretical systems. Martin Heidegger transformed Husserl's phenomenology into something more profound and troubling. Known as the Little Magician from Messkirch, Heidegger cultivated a rustic persona, wearing specially tailored Black Forest dress while teaching at Freiburg University. Students described his impenetrable quality that gave him mesmerizing hold over classes, with lectures featuring breathtaking swirls of questions culminating in deep, dark clouds of sentences from which lightning flashed. His 1927 masterpiece, Being in Time, opened with a call to amazement about the question of being. The work distinguishes between beings, particular entities like mice or church doors, and being itself, which he calls the ontological difference. Humans, whom Heidegger calls Dasein or their being, have a preliminary understanding of being, making us the best starting point for ontological inquiry. Heidegger's frustrating, innovative, language-avoiding terms like humanity, mind, or consciousness forces readers to question familiar concepts. His biggest philosophical innovation was approaching Dasein through everyday life rather than abstract contemplation. In our everydayness, we are being in the world, typically busy with purposeful activities, hammering nails rather than contemplating hammers. This reveals Dasein's concern with things and its general mode of care. Heidegger also identified how humans tend to fall under the sway of das Man, the they, an impersonal entity that robs us of freedom to think for ourselves. Authentic living requires hearing the voice of conscience, not from God, but from one's authentic self. This call demands taking responsibility and making decisions. Yet despite this philosophy that seemed to advocate resistance to conformity, Heidegger himself embraced Nazism. In April 1933, he accepted the position of rector at Freiburg University, joined the Nazi Party, and delivered pro-Nazi speeches. His private Black Notebooks, published in 2014, confirmed his Nazi convictions and anti-Semitic views. In his inaugural address as rector, Heidegger twisted existentialist concepts of self-questioning and freedom to align with Nazi ideology, calling for students to place their existence in the most acute danger in the midst of overpowering being. While Heidegger retreated to his Black Forest hut, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir developed existentialism as a philosophy of engagement with the world. Sartre's brilliance lay in applying phenomenology to ordinary human experiences. By the end of World War II, his ideas about radical freedom had made him a celebrity. Sartre's novel Nausea, 1938, featured Antoine Roquentin, a writer researching an 18th-century courtier in the seaside town of Beauville. Roquentin discovers he can't write the biography because life lacks the neat structure of adventure stories. It's merely contingent, causing him waves of nausea when confronting objects' raw existence. In the novel's pivotal scene, Roquentin stares at a chestnut tree's boiled leather surface and realizes what bothers him is the tree's sheer being, its inexplicable, pointless thisness. Only when listening to a jazz record does he find relief, as the music creates necessity, where each note follows another with purpose. Sartre's philosophical masterwork, Being a Nothingness, 1943, divided all being into two realms, the pour soi, for itself, human consciousness defined by its freedom, and the en soi, in itself, everything else that simply exists without decisions to make. Through café examples like looking for Pierre who isn't there, or finding 1,300 francs in one's wallet when expecting 1,500, Sartre demonstrated that consciousness has no substance. It is merely an intentional reaching toward things. In his reversal of Descartes, I am nothing, therefore I am free. This radical freedom produces anxiety, angoisse, because we are nothing beyond what we decide to be. To avoid this anxiety, we engage in bad faith, mauvaise foi, pretending we're not free through alarm clocks, social roles, like the waiter playing at being a waiter, or blaming external factors for our choices. Simone de Beauvoir applied existentialist philosophy to women's experiences in her groundbreaking work, The Second Sex, 1949. Her central argument was that being female profoundly shapes one's existence in ways most people, including women themselves, fail to recognize. Beyond obvious legal inequalities, Beauvoir identified deeper existential differences. The book's famous assertion that one is not born, but rather becomes a woman, introduced its analysis of how girls learn different ways of being in the world from early childhood. Beauvoir's most profound insight came from applying Hegel's master-slave dialectic to gender relations. The master perceives everything from his viewpoint, but bizarrely, so does the slave, who adopts his perspective even on herself. Women become other rather than transcendent subjects, constantly seeing themselves through the male gaze. This explains women's preoccupation with mirrors and why both sexes see women as the more sexual sex. Maurice Merleau-Ponty, though less celebrated than his contemporaries Sartre and Beauvoir, developed what many consider the most revolutionary philosophical approach of the existentialists. His masterwork, The Phenomenology of Perception, 1945, established him as an influential figure who uniquely bridged the gap between psychology and philosophy. Unlike Sartre, who found human limitations painful to accept and fought against them, Merleau-Ponty calmly recognized that we exist through constant compromise with the world, focusing his work on understanding how this essential compromise functions rather than resisting it. Merleau-Ponty significantly expanded on Husserl's phenomenology by emphasizing that all experience comes through our sensitive, moving bodies. Even our most abstract thought processes rely on physical metaphors. We grasp concepts, wrestle with ideas, and hold beliefs. We rarely experience sensations in their raw form. Phenomena come to us already shaped by interpretations and expectations based on our previous experiences. When we look at a chair, for instance, we don't first see brown patches and geometric shapes that we then decode into chair. We immediately perceive it as a meaningful whole, complete with its function and context. Similarly, when watching a soccer match, we don't see 11 individual players moving independently, but rather perceive the team as a unified entity with purpose and strategy. His exploration of proprioception, our innate sense of where our body parts are positioned, revealed profound insights about embodied consciousness. Unlike external objects that we must actively locate, our body is immediately present to us. I might have to hunt for my knitting needles, but I don't hunt for my hands. This bodily awareness extends beyond our physical form to objects we use regularly, creating what he called an extended body schema. A skilled driver feels the dimensions of their car as naturally as their own limbs. A tennis player's racket becomes an extension of their arm. A woman maintains a safe distance between the feather in her hat and objects that might damage it. She senses where the feather is, just as we sense where our hand is. For Merleau-Ponty, consciousness could never be the pure nothingness that Sartre described. Instead, he offered a more nuanced and beautiful metaphor. Consciousness is like a fold in the fabric of the world, a crumpled hollow in cloth that maintains its form for a while before being smoothed away. This concept evolved into his later idea of the chiasm, from the Greek letter chi, describing consciousness as an intricate intertwining with the world, like crossed hands grasping each other, or a knitting stitch holding fabric together. The hold is held. We see things because we too can be seen. When I touch something, it touches me back. This reciprocal relationship extends to all our sensory experiences. We are both perceiving subjects and perceived objects, simultaneously affecting and being affected by the world around us. Through these concepts, Merleau-Ponty developed a philosophy that recognized human consciousness not as separate from the physical world, but as deeply embedded within it, creating a more holistic understanding of human experience that continues to influence fields from cognitive science to artificial intelligence. The existentialists' philosophies were forged in the crucible of World War II and the Nazi occupation of France. When Germany invaded France in May 1940, Sartre was captured and held as a prisoner of war, while Beauvoir remained in Paris under occupation. These experiences profoundly shaped their thinking about freedom, responsibility, and engagement. Paris under occupation maintained an uncanny normalcy, except for Germans strolling everywhere, some arrogant, others embarrassed. Beauvoir resumed writing in cafes despite Nazi officers at nearby tables. She made compromises to survive, signing a document stating she wasn't Jewish or a Freemason to keep her teaching position, finding black market food, and learning to salvage spoiled meat with vinegar and herbs. The collaborationist government's moralistic propaganda, exhorting respect for God, family, and traditional virtues, reminded her of the bourgeois talk she'd hated in childhood, but now backed by violence. Meanwhile, Sartre was imprisoned at Stalag 12D in Trier, immersed in reading Heidegger's Being and Time. He found Heidegger's philosophy, born partly from Germany's 1918 humiliation, perfectly suited to France's 1940 defeat. While reading, he developed notes for his own philosophical treatise, which would become Being and Nothingness. Sartre escaped using his eye condition as pretext, securing a medical pass to visit an ophthalmologist outside the camp, and simply walking out. Upon his return to Paris, Sartre formed the resistance group Socialisme et Liberté with a dozen friends. The group primarily wrote manifestos and articles, dangerous enough activities. They faced a frightening moment when Jean Pouillon lost a briefcase containing incriminating pamphlets and their names and addresses, but it was fortuitously turned in to a lost property office, an incongruity capturing the strange duality of occupied life. Sartre's play The Flies, which opened on June 3, 1943, dramatized his ideas about freedom in the context of occupied France. Using the classical story of Orestes, Sartre portrayed a hero who returns to his hometown of Argos to find it ruled by the tyrant Aegisthus and plagued by flies representing the citizens' demoralization and shame. The parallels to the French situation under Nazi occupation were clear. The debilitating effects of compromise, the humiliation of living under tyranny, and the moral burden that came with resistance. After liberation, existentialism exploded into public consciousness. Sartre's October 1945 lecture, Existentialism and Humanism, ended in mayhem and made headlines. The philosophy spread throughout Paris and beyond, with Gabrielle Marcel noting that hardly a day goes by without my being asked what is existentialism by everyone from society ladies to ticket collectors. However, the Cold War soon created painful divisions among the existentialists. With the Soviet Union's atomic bomb test in 1949 and the Korean War erupting in 1950, intellectuals were forced to take sides in the global ideological conflict. Camus maintained his stance against political violence, declaring in Neither Victims Nor Executioners that he rejected formal justifications for violence. When asked about his failure to support Algerian rebels, he famously said, People are now planting bombs in the tramways of Algiers. My mother might be on one of those tramways. If that is justice, then I prefer my mother. Sartre initially shared Camus' position, but later shifted, deciding one must weigh lives in a judicious way, viewing Camus' position as evasive. After the bizarre pigeon plot of May 1952, when French Communist Party leader Jacques Duclos was arrested after police claimed two pigeons in his car were message carriers for Soviet masters, Sartre experienced what he called his conversion. Writing frantically on Coradrain, an amphetamine, he produced The Communists and Peace, a passionate defense of the Soviet state. The final rupture with Camus came after Camus published The Rebel in 1951, presenting a theory of rebellion opposed to Marxist historical determinism. When Camus responded to a harsh review with a 17-page letter mocking critics who merely turned their armchair in history's direction, Sartre wrote a blistering personal attack, declaring their friendship over. Sartre upset another old friend in 1952 by publishing his first Communists and Peace article in Le Temps Moderne without showing it to co-editor Merleau-Ponty, knowing he might object. Their disagreement exploded that summer in heated letters, with Merleau-Ponty declaring he would no longer issue hasty political responses to events, which Sartre saw as a retreat. The final break came when Sartre removed Merleau-Ponty's editorial disclaimer from a pro-Soviet piece without telling him. Existentialism spread worldwide in the 1950s and 1960s, influencing life more profoundly than any other modern philosophy. It fed feminism, gay rights, class barrier dissolution, and anti-racist and anti-colonial struggles, fundamentally changing our existence. It also inspired personal liberation through existentialist psychotherapy, with practitioners like Medard Boss, Ludwig Binswanger, Rollo May, Irvin Yalom, R.D. Lang, and Viktor Frankl, developing therapeutic approaches grounded in existentialist principles. In America, existentialism resonated with post-war disillusionment with suburban conformity. A decade of authenticity dramas emerged across literature, theater, and cinema, from beat writers to films like Rebel Without a Cause and Godard's About to Souffle. Even lighter fare like Funny Face featured Audrey Hepburn performing an existentialist dance, while Sloane Wilson's The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit showed a war veteran rejecting corporate conformity for authentic living. A new breed of existentialist rebels emerged in sociology, psychology, and philosophy. David Riesman's The Lonely Crowd examined modern alienation, followed by Irvin Goffman's The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, William White's Organization Man, and Paul Goodman's Growing Up Absurd. Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem portrayed the Holocaust organizer as the ultimate conformist bureaucrat, exemplifying what she called the banality of evil. By the 1960s, existentialism was capturing students' imagination. Philosophy professor J. Glenn Gray noted in 1965 that students were increasingly fascinated by philosophers representing rebellion and authenticity. This popularized brand of existentialism fed into the growing counterculture, adding its terminology and transformative energy to student radicals, hippies, and anti-Vietnam War protesters. Existentialism proved especially vital behind the Iron Curtain. In Czechoslovakia, after the 1968 Soviet invasion, young Czechs and Slovaks devoured Sartre's works as if freshly published. Czech phenomenologist Jan Pataka, who had studied with both Husserl and Heidegger, spoke of the solidarity of the shaken, a bond uniting those whose lives had been jolted out of unthinking everydayness by historical upheaval. In 1976, the nearly 70-year-old Pataka joined Václav Havel in signing Charter 77, a declaration of political opposition. Havel's famous 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, dedicated to Pataka, argued that in an oppressive state, dissidents must conduct an epoche, setting aside ideological cant to see what's truly before their eyes. The existentialists have vanished, and the thrill they once inspired, like Iris Murdoch's exclamation about Sartre, the excitement, I remember nothing like it, is harder to recapture. Yet their ideas have become so embedded in modern culture, we hardly recognize them as existentialist. Anxiety, bad faith, authenticity, and the paradoxes of freedom permeate our discourse. Freedom may prove the great puzzle of our early 21st century. While some freedoms have expanded as expected, the very concept has been radically challenged. We can no longer agree on what freedom means, what it's for, how much we need, or how much we're willing to surrender for convenience. Science increasingly tells us we're not truly free agents, but collections of irrational, predictable responses veiled by the illusion of conscious control. Heidegger's engagement with technology and ecology merits attention from contemporary readers. In his 1953 lecture, The Question Concerning Technology, he argued that technology isn't merely clever devices, but reveals something fundamental about existence. The essence of technology is nothing technological. Investigating it leads to deeper questions about how we work, occupy Earth, and relate to being. Later Heideggerians like Hubert Dreyfus have analyzed the internet as revealing technology's essence. Its infinite connectivity promises to make everything available while removing privacy and depth, turning everything, including ourselves, into resources handed over to an impersonal they. The imponderable bloom of life, a phrase from E.M. Forster's prescient 1909 story, The Machine Stops, lies at the heart of human mystery. This bloom of experience is precisely what phenomenologists and existentialists studied, the quality of experience as we live it, not as explained away by various philosophical frameworks. Of all these thinkers, Maurice Merleau-Ponty most directly tackled this bloom in The Phenomenology of Perception, describing how we live from moment to moment, from a woman ducking in a tall hat to a man watching a branch vibrate after a bird's departure. Simone de Beauvoir shared Merleau-Ponty's instinct for human complexity, exploring how constraint and freedom shape our becoming. This theme guides The Second Sex, The Ethics of Ambiguity, and her multi-volume autobiography, where she chronicles herself, Sartre, and countless others thinking, acting, quarreling, and responding to their world. Her memoirs make her one of the 20th century's greatest intellectual chroniclers and most diligent phenomenologists, observing experience, expressing astonishment at being alive, and indulging her appetite for everything encountered. The existentialists offer no simple solution for modern problems. They were hopelessly flawed as individuals and philosophers, each harboring uncomfortable aspects in their thought, shaped by their dark, morally compromised century. Yet this is precisely why they demand rereading. They remind us of both human limitations and possibilities, constantly reviving questions about freedom and being that we try to forget. They capture both the fury of existentialist cafes and life's exquisite phosphorescent bloom, which reveals itself to human beings for as long as we are lucky enough to be able to experience it.